From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, an award-winning fashion designer returns to Milwaukee, the place it all started for her.
The great thing that Mount Mary did back then, which inspired me to move to New York ultimately, was to introduce me to so many professionals.
Later, if you don't already, why you should know the story of Milwaukee native Lance Cijon.
Anybody who wouldn't appreciate this story is soulless, in my mind, because it goes to the grain. And it's not even, and I say all-American, it doesn't do it justice. It's a human story. It permeates through everything.
And singer-songwriter Caitlin Canty talks about the point when she gave up using her biology degree in favor of the music life.
I actually was up for a promotion, and I quit. I just really felt like if I didn't give it a try, I never would do it.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. When you think of the fashion centers of the world, cities like New York, Paris, and Milan often come to mind. And while it's true that the most influential design houses are in those cities, fashion designers themselves come from all over. Like, for example, Milwaukee. That was the case for Donna Rico, who got her start in the fashion department at Mount Mary University. She went on to found a dress company that earned fans like First Lady Michelle Obama.
More recently, though, Rico sold the company and spent time figuring out what would come next. It turns out that her next act takes a page from her first act. Rico will return in part to Mount Mary, where she'll become an executive fellow in the fashion department, regularly spending time with students at her alma mater. She was back in town last week, and we met up with her on the Mount Mary campus on Milwaukee's West Side. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Oh, I'm so happy to do it. I'm so excited with this new position, and I think that I'm just anxious to share what I hope to be doing here with for the school and the students at Mount Mary.
So let me ask you, why is this the time to reestablish your ties with Mount Mary and Milwaukee? Not that you have ever, you know, completely distanced yourself, but you say it's been a while since you've really spent any time here. Why was this the time to reconnect the way you're doing?
Well, things changed for me about 4 years ago. I stopped working in the industry in New York. I'm very proud of the brand I built, and I left it in good standing, and I wish them well in continuing to develop clothing for that label. But when I stopped working, I realized that I still loved to follow fashion, and I read about fashion every day. I love the creativity, the business, and I've been storing all of these ideas and articles and things in my drive, and I was contacted by Mount Mary about 6 months ago, and they were looking to fill a chair position here at the school. And they were asking for my thoughts and maybe for me to share my network in order for them to draw some candidates. And as we talked, I realized, and after looking at the job description, I realized that this is something that maybe I could help them with. And I wasn't looking to do something, to make a move. I still live in New York, and but I felt, well, there's, with technology these days, there's things I can do from here to help them, and certainly I'd love to be in the classroom and help critique and such. So they were very patient, and we had a couple of meetings, and we came up with this position that I think really speaks to what I hope to be doing for the school.
Can you think about the time when you were a student? I mean, can you talk about what drew you as someone who grew up in this area to fashion in the first place?
Well, I was always creative as a kid, and as a student, I focused on art classes. I loved art. I loved drawing. I loved ceramics in high school. When it was time to think about college, I started in the art program at UWM. And loved it. I loved doing them, learning about graphics and painting and drawing, life drawing, and really, really loved all of it. At the same time, I was sewing. And I would, sew from patterns, and I would get very creative with the fabrics to the patterns, and I would change things. And I realized that, maybe I could combine my two loves. So fashion design was the concept, And I discovered that Mount Mary had a fashion design program. I had an interview. They looked at my portfolio and they accepted me. So after about 2 years at UWM, I switched over to Mount Mary and studied in their fashion program.
Well, and how did the program here at Mount Mary kind of, I don't know, shape what you maybe wanted from life and from that world?
Well, I didn't realize what I wanted at that point. As a local girl, I thought, well, maybe I'll have a dress shop and I'll make clothes for people here in Milwaukee. I didn't have any plans to leave. And what happened when I started with here at Mount Mary is I was introduced to so many concepts and so many possibilities in the world of fashion. The great thing that Mount Mary did back then, which inspired me to move to New York ultimately, was to introduce me to so many professionals from the industry, from New York mostly, and also local at the time. There was more manufacturing here in Milwaukee at that point. And the people that came in were just, I was like a sponge. I was so inspired, you know, to hear them tell their stories. And I started to realize that, gee, this kind of makes sense, that maybe I could take this further than staying here.
It takes a certain amount of a leap of faith, if you will, to be able to go from being a 20-something getting out of college and saying, okay, well, I'm going to go to New York and we'll just see what happens.
Well, yes, it does. And I credit my family for supporting me in that effort. Certainly, before I moved to New York, I lived at home. I commuted to school every day. But when I realized the potential that I had entered a national design competition when I was here as a student. And the first year I placed 14th out of about 1,500 entrants across the country. And the second year I placed second. And so after I won that award, I went to New York to collect the award at the event that they held. And it was judged by people like Calvin Klein and Bernadine Morris, who was the fashion reporter for the Times, and all kinds of fashion people. It was sponsored by the ILGWU, if you remember that, International Ladies Garment Workers.
Yeah.
And anyway, I realized that I had something that maybe should go further than staying here in Milwaukee, and I just had this drive within me to do something more. And even back then, I was reading about the designers. I would read Women's Wear Daily every day, and I would target certain designers and look at what the products they did, and I scheduled interviews with them when I went to New York for this event, and they looked at my portfolio and they were positive. Of course, being from Milwaukee was a bit of a challenge. I didn't have that New York experience that students at FIT or Parsons might have. But I did have the talent that they recognized. And so it was enough for me to come back to Milwaukee and make a plan to, you know, take this adventure and make the move and see what happens. And I had a different plan when I moved. I thought I would work for another company. And you know, learn the business, as they say. But I ended up starting to wear some of the clothes that I was making. I had a cousin who had a art gallery in New York, and he would invite me to openings, and I would wear my own things. And some of his clients would come up to me and ask, well, what are you wearing? That's so new and different, and it really is unique. Can you make me one of those? And really, that's how it started.
Wow.
I think with that confidence the fact that I had the ability to put my thoughts in order, and also it was a lot of hard work.
Right, that's the underrated part of this. There's a
right.
There's a lot of thought that genius just is, but genius
right.
also requires a ton of work too.
And I think anyone who's thinking about being an entrepreneur in any business has to realize that it's more than just an idea. You can have a great idea, but if you don't have the ability to put the time and the effort and the resilience to make it through the times of failure, you know, certainly I experienced that, and I did still up, you know, every day. But you have to get through it, and you have to respect it. And I tried to learn from it and apply it to my, you know, things that happened after. And I think having that positive attitude helps in many ways in life.
Well, but at the same time, there seems to be within that hard work a whole lot of creativity that has to go into, you know, how do I put that work into practice? I'm not sure that most people would say, well, I'm going to wear the stuff that I have designed to gallery openings and put that in their business plan.
Well, that sort of just happened. I mean, that's what I had in my closet. And so, you know, I guess, yes, it was sort of serendipitous that I was able to promote my talent by wearing it. It wasn't like I was an artist and had to show my portfolio. And meanwhile, remember, back when I started, there was no internet, there were no computers, there was no social media. So it was really, you know, you had to go out and you had to do stuff, you had to be seen, and you had to present yourself in a way that you could connect with people. And I think that's really another reason that I had success early on, is that I listen. I love to talk to people. I feel like, you know, you can learn so much by walking up to someone and having a conversation. So I think all of that helped me have the ability to just, you know, start out with nothing, work very hard, and make small steps, but the enough right steps, more right than wrong. I made the mistakes when, you know, I was little, and again, learned from them. I developed great relationships as I went along, starting with small specialty stores who would, you know, order 5 or 6 pieces, which I would sew myself in the beginning. As the business grew, I was able to hire sewers, and finally found a factory that would do cutting and sewing as the orders got bigger. That's really how it all started.
You mentioned when you first went to New York, it was difficult for someone from Milwaukee who went to school here, who didn't have those New York fashion connections. Do you think, is that still the case for people who come from elsewhere to New York?
Oh, not so much. I think that, you know, with technology and there's so many more opportunities to see and to share for students and to become more aware of their opportunities in other parts of the world. It's not, certainly moving to New York is not an easy task, okay? You have to have a plan, you have to, again, be willing to work hard and make your way. But I think these days that really anyone, providing they have the spirit and the talent and the idea, I mean, I think it's all about having that idea that you believe in, and that's different than what the next person is doing. Fashion is very competitive. In education and in the business, in the creativity, and that's what I thrived on. That I, you know, whoever, there were always many dresses in the market. Why did they buy a Donna Rico dress? It's because it fit them, it flattered them, it was comfortable, and people would look at the woman wearing the dress and not just say, oh, that's a great dress, but they'd say, you look great in that dress. And what woman doesn't want to hear that?
I have an interview in a few days with a woman who, she's the author of what's subtitled A Midlife Coming of Age Story, a woman named Pamela Druckerman. She lives in Paris. She's American. She and her English husband raised their kids in Paris. But there's a chapter on understanding what she wants from her wardrobe in her late 40s.
Okay.
And the line that really stuck with me, she writes, anxiety is at the core of Americans' relationship with fashion, that we, as Americans, put a lot of pressure on ourselves in terms of what we want out of the perfect garments. Do you subscribe to that notion, and is that just the way it is, or as a designer, is that something that you work to change?
Well, personally, I have that feeling. I'm always very serious about what I'm going to wear every day. I can be going out into the garden. Well, now should I wear these shorts or this chambray shirt, and how should I protect myself from the poison ivy? But you know, I think about that all the time, and I think I have a comfortable relationship with my closet and my clothing. And, you know, I've been in the business a long time, and it was my business to make clothing that flattered the woman and hopefully gave her the confidence to wear a dress. You know, dresses is a whole nother psychological concept in clothing for women. I love talking to women in stores. When I was working and I would have trunk shows in the department stores, and I'd meet the customers, and I learned so much just from talking to them and seeing what their, you know, their issues were. A lot of it is psychological. It's not having the confidence to put on a dress, or if it doesn't fit, I can see why they would be a little nervous. But once, you know, my goal as a designer was to make something that would fit her and make her feel good. And once, you know, they start getting that feedback, wearing these clothes, I think that's a big confidence builder.
Do you ever have occasion to sew anymore?
You know what? I do. I missed sewing all my years of working. I was creating and I was, you know, handling fabrics, but I was directing others to make the products. I ran a sample room where, you know, but I never really had to sit down at the machine myself. And once I stopped doing that every day, I had the time and really the desire to get back at it. So about two years ago, I bought myself a new little sewing machine, and I am sewing again for myself. It's a challenge in that I miss having the ability to buy all kinds of fabrics and feel them that I used to have when I was working in the industry. Now I buy most things retail, obviously. And again, you can shop online for fabric and have many more options that way. But I love it. I love the idea of working with my hands and you know, thinking about, again, what do I want to wear? And I think that I've always kind of been my own customer. And I think that's what also made me successful, is to look in my own closet and say, well, okay, this was fine, you know, 5 years ago, but now my figure has changed maybe, and I want to cover my arms rather than have sleeveless all the time. And those are the kinds of challenges, I think, as women mature, that makes it harder for them, certainly, to find clothing. But when you're sewing for yourself, you can just make it.
Is there a certain kind of muscle memory that had to come back to be able to do it again?
You know, it all came back pretty quickly. I mean, there were things, you know, handling the tissue paper patterns, and it was great because it reminded me of when I was, you know, when I was starting out. And to go back to those experiences and to have to, you know, rip the seam because the sewing isn't right, or to change the fit of something. I do my own fittings, and it's like, oh, now I have to rip it. But, you know.
I think that there are probably a lot of people, a lot of sewers who will listen to this and be greatly relieved to hear you say that you still have to rip the seam and start over.
No, I do. And it's, we all make mistakes, I guess. Nobody's perfect.
Well, Donna Rico, I have about 25,000 other questions I could ask you, but at this point, I'll just say thank you so much, and let's talk again soon.
Okay, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Fashion designer Donna Rico is a Milwaukee native, Mount Mary University graduate, and founder of the dress company that's named for her. She was named this month as an executive fellow in the fashion department in Mount Mary School of Arts and Design. You can read more about her and her new role at WUWM.com.
Milwaukeeans today might be familiar with the Bayview Park named after Lance Cijon, but the story of Cijon himself is not as well known. We'll hear about Cijon and his legacy when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee native Lance Cijon was on a night mission over Laos in 1967 when a bomb he was set to deploy exploded, taking the airplane with it. He successfully ejected from the plane but suffered a concussion and a broken leg and hands. A helicopter rescue attempt was unsuccessful, and Cijon crawled through the jungle for more than a month before he was captured by the North Vietnamese.
Cijon was interrogated and tortured in two POW camps before he died of pneumonia in 1968. But it's his entire life story that his sister Janine Cijon Rosena wants people to know. She's worked with writer Stephen Miller on a biography of her brother. She and Miller, plus Air Force Air National Guard Captain Nathan Wallen, joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio back in 2016 to talk about Cijon's legacy.
We really are trying to focus on what happened up to that point in his life, because justifiably so, he's recognized, it's well documented. But how does a young man become that? How do any of us become great leaders in things that we engage in and are passionate about? So I would say that Lance, he grew up in Bayview, Wisconsin, and, you know, we're from a hardworking community and family, and his decisions to stay on the right side of right, I think, was something that drove him from a young boy on. Also, his willingness to get up when he fell down. So that's when we talk about the determination and the fortitude to continue to move forward when, in fact, you've fallen. So those decisions had been made throughout his entire life. And so he could excel in high school as the all-city end on the football team, on the championship football team. And he was the president of the student government. He was the president of his class. But he was multifaceted. So he was also, so this guy who was playing football, going head-to-head on the gridiron, the next semester he's in the operetta, The King and I, and he's the king. So he had a very artistic approach to things in his life, too. And there was a point in his life that he wanted to go on to school to become an artist, to be able to express that, was which was intrinsically part of him. And he wanted to showcase that in art forms that included music, sculpting, and painting. So he was quite an artist. And so, much to people's misunderstanding of what somebody that is recognized as he is for the last 3 months of his life, he had this very soft artistic side. But he also showed that his determination, his decision to make these choices in his life, and the responsibility that comes with those choices, he was very driven to do his very best. And so he could accept in others and himself, if we do our very best, but we're not necessarily graded with the A+, we brought our best. And that's what's most important. And that's what people will tell you that knew him. He always brought his best. He was almost intolerant if you didn't bring your best. So he was willing to engage with you if you're both working on bringing out that very best within yourself. And so that's a big message that he, I think, is trying to reach out and tell us. The fact that he survived the 46 days and then another month after that, to inspire those in the prison camp, and ultimately to inspire so many of us, whether you knew him, you didn't know him, but you've heard of him, or you're going to hear of him. It's going to be an incredible vision and journey within yourself to say, if he could do that, then I can do this.
Some qualities people have naturally and intrinsically, but your father was also a big football player at Bayview High School, and it's yourself, Lance, and one other brother?
Yes, Mark.
What was your family dynamic like? Did your father have a big influence on Lance, or was it just an overall Midwest work ethic, like you need to do this and do your best, and he decided to take it to the Air Force later in life?
There was a tremendous connection in our family, and the dynamics were such that Lance and I were 12 years apart. Mark and I were 8 years apart. And my father was a strong, strong influence in Lance's life. However, if you'll talk to a childhood friend of Lance's, he'll say that Lanny, as he was called growing up, was dressed by my mom to perfection, and his manners and his mannerisms were directed by my mom. And then, as Charlie Larson says, at 12 years old, when Lance showed up after that summer, he was in blue jeans and he was a regular tough kid, and then he was directed by the father. And so I found that very interesting because it allowed him to develop that soft, passionate side that my mom had, genteel, charismatic, graceful, if you will, and artistic. And then my father could enter at age 12, even though he was, of course, participating, engaging with Lance and loved Lance very much. But I think that at age 12, it really began to show. So my dad was very, very involved in Lance's life. My dad was the same Bayview Redcat football team, championship team, 1939, as well as the All-City End. So preceding Lance, my dad did the same thing. So it was pretty interesting. The correspondence between my brother and the family, but you could see that he was really talking to my dad in these family letters, of which I have 5 years of correspondence at the end of Lance's 5 years of his life. And we're able to see the young boy become a young man through his own letters, through the letters that my dad sent him that he saved. It was quite extraordinary.
It must be great to go back into this in even greater detail now as you're putting this book together. And as you mentioned, your family's from Bayview. Some people living either in Milwaukee or the South Side may recognize Cy-John Field on Kinnickinnick Avenue, where people play softball tournaments, and or even his jet right on College Avenue, which I never knew was his jet until I was looking into this story a little bit. I always saw that it was there and it was outside of the Air Force Base, but I didn't know that connection. And it's so interesting to find these things happening right in the neighborhood that I've lived in all my life that I didn't know the backstory. So how have people here in Milwaukee responded to your brother's story over the years? Because you've been doing outreach about your brother for a while, and now it's coming to fruition in this book. But do you think people are losing touch with the local history?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It was such an unpopular war. And I think part of the separation from it was because of the politics of the war, and nobody really wanted to engage in that time frame, what was happening. It's difficult for individuals to separate who Lance was as an individual as opposed to the war itself. And so I think it was just uncomfortable for people to talk about that time, and because their inability to separate that story, it didn't often get recognized. And so it's been only of late that Milwaukee has really rallied around their boy. And in to that point, I'm working right now on getting that very plane you're talking about, that F-4C that is in honor of Lance on the south end of Mitchell Airport on College Avenue. It was once the home of the 440th Air Force Reserve, and they actually brought that plane up initially. They moved out of Milwaukee, and now the plane sort of sits idly there. And I've been working for over 7 years to get that plane moved and approved, and it has been, in fact. And it will now find its home at the front of International Airport, Mitchell International Airport, on the Inner Drive. So we're working to do that, and we're asking for any support in any kind of in-kind services that people want to offer to help make that happen, because actually the funding of it is up to me. But there are other awards given out. There are leadership awards here locally given out. Of course, you said, you know, Cy-John Field. But in the military, it's an incredible recognition of what they have determined as what Lance gave back in service to the Air Force, how he abided by the code of conduct. And the highest leadership award given out every year out of the Pentagon is the Cy-John Award.
Right, so let's bring in Nathan here. You've been helpful in coordinating this interview, but you are in the Air Force, so why don't you introduce yourself and go into Lance's legacy within the Air Force as a professional figure?
Captain Nathan Wallen, Air Force, Air National Guard. So in the Air Force, we have our three core values: integrity, service, and excellence. Integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all we do. And I've been through, I'm an officer, I'm a prior enlisted officer, so I've been to basic training twice, and both times through the formal course of instruction, you learn about Lance Cy-John, particularly in officer school, because Lance, Captain Cy-John, was an officer, and you learn about his ordeal while he was in captivity with the enemy in the Vietnam War, and you learn specifically about the code of conduct. So as Janine was saying, he never gave up any information. He was always looking for a way to escape. And beyond that, and this is a big one with the airmen, with the fellow prisoners, is he was always keeping morale up. I heard an anecdote this morning that I hadn't heard, that he actually, you know, tried to order a cheeseburger when he was in captivity. You know, just cracking jokes, talking about escaping, you know, never losing hope. And to any, you know, American military member in a situation like that, you have to keep hope. And that's why he's recognized. That's why he's become this embodiment of our core values. I mean, you know, he should be a real point of pride for the city of Milwaukee. You know, Milwaukee has General Billy Mitchell, widely regarded as the father of the Air Force, and it also has Lance, you know, Captain Lance Cy-John, the largest cadet dormitory at the Air Force Academy is named in his honor. Countless awards are named after Captain Cy-John. There's a Cy-John Drive nearly every Air Force base you go to, and there's a reason why, because when you look for an example of what you want your service to be, what you want your service to your country to mean, you look at Lance Cy-John.
That's fantastic. With this book not only going into his legacy as a member of the Air Force, but his legacy as a person and the brother that you knew, what is your vision for this book? And for both Janine and Stephen, we'll bring you in this too as a co-author. What is this book going to look like, and why did you two choose to work together?
Well, I'm not a nonfiction writer. I'm not from Milwaukee. I'm not in the military. So I come completely out of left field. I'm a novelist out of New York, and while doing research for a novel, I came upon Lance's story. And I had heard his story before, but in looking at it now, it seemed just time to tell a story. I'd never met Janine before. I'd never spoke to her. We didn't know each other existed, really. So I just reached out. I reached out and just social media said, this is what I want to do. This is who I am. And initially, and I don't think I'm talking out of school, I think Janine had a sense of trepidation because I can't imagine, as I said before, and it's going to sound like rote to Janine, but any writer who wouldn't want to write Lance's story is crazy. It's a perfect story to write. So we got in contact, and over the course of months, there's a certain level of trust that goes in. You know, Janine gave me her vision of what she wanted this to be, and I gave her mine. And at some point in the middle, it meets. And through all this amazing correspondence between Lance and his family, I get to write through Lance's eyes. I mean, you talk about a writer's dream. I'm writing through the eyes of somebody who's actually, you know, memorialized as such a hero. And I'm obviously not trying to sully his memory, but there's a part of his life where he's actually, you know, he's a human being. He's not a Greek god. He's not a deity. So to see some of, and I wouldn't say weaknesses, some of his, you know, other sides is fascinating. And he was such an amazing individual that to tell his story, and I think where this book would really, you know, differentiate from where someone else might write is that I want to tell the story about how he lived, not how he died. I mean, obviously the last 3 months of his life, that's a big part of the story, but most of the story is going to be about how he lived, what formed this young man. And he was a young man. If you look at it, you know, he was 24, correct, when he passed. 24-year-olds now, if, and I've said this before, if their, you know, iPhone breaks, they're in a sense of panic. So if you look, and it's not that long ago. It's not ancient history. It's not the 1800s. This is an available person for someone to look at. And I think now this is my first time in Milwaukee, but I think even on the local level for young people who go play at Cy John Field, who see the Jets, go, whoa, this is what this guy was about. And that's part of it. That's a lot of it. And I also think, and I've said to Janine as well, the fact that outside of Colorado Springs, where the Air Force Academy is, and Milwaukee, not much is known about Lance. I'm from New York, and if I walk down the street in Manhattan and ask 100 people who Lance Cijon was, nobody would know him. And to me, that's almost, and I know this is a harsh word, but that's almost disgraceful that, you know, in an age where, you know, so much is written about people who do so little, that very little is written about Lance Cijon. And this guy really was the all-American boy who became timeless. He literally is timeless. There's no end to his story. He's a fascinating guy to look at. As a writer, it's a writer's dream come true.
And what's it like for the two of you to go through, you mentioned you have 5 years of correspondence, and as I understand, there's also recordings that he sent home. So there's his actual voice speaking and relaying his story and the history of when he was serving. What's it like for you guys to go through these, just not only as co-authors, but as his sister and as someone being introduced to his story?
Well, it's been quite a journey. As I became a mother myself, I began to look through the lens, a much different lens, and become very protective of him and want to maintain the integrity of his story and also the fullness of it. So to do that, you have to journey back, and you have to look at some of these letters, of which I had not looked at in 40 years. And to hear his voice, it's challenging. It's very challenging. So I have a couple of hours of correspondence from him, with him talking in Vietnam, in Da Nang. And there's something about a voice that connects to just about every fiber in your soul. And it's so recognizable. It's much like when in nature an animal calls out and a mother knows the call of their baby, the cry of their baby. So there's something so unique about that sound. And so when I heard his voice, it was challenging, very, very challenging. But I have come to a place where, as Stephen said, I would much rather start to revisit and look at the way he lived and not cut that portion out because the end was so tragic and painful and we felt such loss. So as we began to look before that more closely, I could really begin to appreciate and feel that sense of connection and love that we had as we shared as we were growing up.
Well, I'm sure the finished product will be not only a tribute to your brother's heroism, but himself as a person. And thank you so much for coming in today and shedding light on this story. And I hope it gets people in Milwaukee to go out and see these things dedicated to your brother and just know his story.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it as well.
Janine Saijon-Rosina is the sister of the late Captain Lance Saijon, who died in a POW camp in North Vietnam in 1968. She and writer Stephen Miller visited with Audrey Nowakowski in 2016 as they were collaborating on a book about Lance. Nathan Wallen is a captain in the Air Force Air National Guard. You can find links to more about Lance Saijon at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then the distinctive voice and the vintage guitar of singer-songwriter Caitlin Canty. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Climbing up switchbacks, walking through tall grass, color matches on summer's hottest night.
You might think that the number of biology majors who have gone into songwriting as a profession would be pretty small. And that may be, yet we've managed to have two people who fit that description in our performance studio in recent days.
We talked with Mark Arelli. He's the holder of a master's degree in biology. On this show not too long ago, Caitlin Canty's biology work came as an undergraduate, but today the Vermont native is a Nashville-based singer-songwriter who has worked with the likes of Wisconsin's Jeffrey Foucault, Peter Bradley Adams, and others.
Canty played a couple of shows in Oconomowoc in May, but joined us in the studio first to share a few songs, including this one from her 2015 album, Reckless Skyline, a song called Get Up.
Get up, get up, get up. Before the road pulls you under.
Caitlin Canty, thank you so much. Great song.
Thank you very much.
That was Get Up from Reckless Skyline.
Yeah.
Right. And welcome to Milwaukee. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
So how did a biology major from Vermont end up living the life of a singer-songwriter in Nashville?
I went to college and I liked science, so that's what I majored in. I also really loved music. I never thought it was a real practical career. Still don't. But I loved it. And I worked for 5 years after college, and I sang some backup in New York City, and I played in the clubs that would have me. And I wrote more songs that I thought I could stand on, you know? And so, I don't know, I never really meant to be a musician. I just couldn't stand not making music.
Was there an epiphany moment when you said, okay, you know, I'm either going to do it or I'm not going to do it?
Yeah, I was 5 years in when I started. My first job right out of college was working for the Artist Den, which is a live music production company. So I got to, you know, learn the ropes of this odd music business and what a writer is and what a green room is and hang around artists and see what they were. But that was a good education. And then I started to work. I used my degree at a green consulting firm. At the time, we were working for Fortune 500. So I was working in a suit in a cubicle in a tall building in New York City and, you know, going to a club in New York at night at Rockwood Music Hall to sing. It was a weird double life to be living. But I did hit a moment where I actually was up for a promotion and I quit. I just really felt like if I didn't give it a try, I never would do it. And that anniversary was 5 days ago and it was 9 years anniversary.
Wow.
So I raise a glass on that one.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thanks.
So in the chronology of Caitlin Candy, there was a period where you were still in New York and you were
decade,
playing.
Decade.
Okay.
Fact.
Oh.
Yeah. A decade. But you know, your part of the country has a lot of my favorite corners to play in. I'm actually this is probably my fourth year coming to do a doubleheader in Oconomowoc at the Three Brothers Farm. It's a flower farm and a chicken farm. And the grandson of the original owner, I play in this beautiful old dairy barn that his grandfather built. And it's like, it feels like a cathedral, a wooden cathedral out in the middle of this beautiful country.
So when you play a dairy barn, mm-hmm. a converted dairy barn, do you feel some kinship or some connection with growing up in Vermont?
Well, I grew up in a town, but I actually think Wisconsin's a lot like Vermont. It's, you know, we have the same kind of exports, cheese.
So very cow-intensive.
Exactly, cow-intensive. And the landscape does remind me of home. We've got a few more taller mountains and tinier little towns. You've got a little more sky out here.
Talk about how you found your voice as a songwriter, either your writing voice or your literal singing voice.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I don't know exactly. I can't really pinpoint the second where I was like, aha. A lot of it had to do with so the type of voice I have, you know, kind of a alto, dusty, crackly voice, and love the lower sounds. I got this guitar, this Recording King, this old 1939.
I was going to say almost 80 years old.
It's just like a friend of mine at this point. I love this old guitar. Around that same time, too, I was writing songs that were pushing the envelope more for me than they had before. And I don't know, when I was a little kid, you know, you think anyone who's a singer, they must have just been wanting to do this their whole lives. I just loved singing. And I remember people would ask me when I was little, you want to be a singer when you grow up? And at that time, the only people I knew were, you know, Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston. And the way they cartwheel with their voices, the general vocal acrobatics, I mean, I was like, hell no. No way. I don't want to dance around on stage. But once I got an acoustic guitar, I think that helped me find my way. I think in college, discovering people like Gillian Welch and listening to Johnny Cash. I grew up on Tom Petty, but once I got obsessed with songs and wondering, you know, when a song hits you and when it sticks to you or when it stings you, like, how does that work? You know, what made that happen? I wanna do that. Yeah, I wanna figure out how that works. And so that's this sort of many-pronged approach to finding my voice, I think. But
so when did that guitar enter your life?
Boy, I think maybe 2012 or 13. Yeah.
How long does it go between the time you acquire a piece like that? Because that guitar had been in, maybe it was a single owner guitar, but
yeah, I don't know.
That guitar would have passed through the hands of at least a few people over those years. How long between the time that you get a guitar like that and it feels like a part of you?
Oh, well, I'd never had this experience before, but I walked into a music store. I didn't intend to buy an old guitar. They're kind of fussy. I use a lot of capos when I'm writing and when I'm playing live. So I was told, if you don't want to be tuning for half of your show, you might want to get a new guitar. But I lucked out with this one. And when I walked into the music store, I think a lot of friends of mine are like this, too. If you're not primarily a guitar player, or perhaps if you're a woman, guitar stores are not often your favorite hang, you know. I don't like playing while there's somebody, you know, on an electric guitar in one room over just wailing away.
You're not shredding
out
of that
recording
kit.
It's not really the vibiest place to, you know, listen to your own, get your hands on a guitar. But this one, the world disappeared, and I started playing my own songs. I started playing songs that I, you know, loved. I started writing on it. I just fell in love with it. So it was mine from the minute I met it.
Wow. Love it. First strum. Well, and you know, I often ask people about their guitars, and partly because, you know, some of them just look more distinctive than others. But honestly, the match between that guitar and your voice is something that even a non-guitar player like me can tell.
That's so cool. Well, I'd played a lot of J45s, and one of my closest musical partners, Peter Bradley Adams. He had a gorgeous J45, and whenever I played it, I was like, this is a real guitar. But I think that suits more of at least his voice, or more of a man's voice, or that deeper sound. And this one's a little, I don't know, more nasally or punchy. It just, I enjoyed singing with it, so thank you. I'm glad you think we work well together.
we should hear another song on it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. How about, so I've got this new record called Motel Bouquet. Noam Pokelny produced it. You probably know him. He's a banjo player in Nashville. He is in the band Punch Brothers. We cut this whole record in Nashville, and it just came out, is it last month? It's now a month and a few weeks ago. This song's called Motel.
In a motel with a bouquet in the ice pail, you can tell them I'm doing okay, doing real well. I got six strings in the morning. The rain danced on the roof last night. Moon rose without warning. Took his time crossing the sky. I could tell you about lonely roads and highway. I could warn you about the trouble and the time it takes. But California woke up this morning with a sweet refrain. Yellow sun beat on the window. The light cut straight through. It was love that broke my sorrow, like day breaks at night. Yellow sun beat on the light cut straight through the blinds. It was love that broke my sorrow, like a day breaks a long night. In a motel with a bouquet in the ice pail, you can tell them I'm doing okay, doing real well.
Oh my gosh, what a great song.
Oh, thank you.
Goosebumps.
Oh, well, you know, I just was flying through Baltimore's airport,
BWI,
the
yes.
other day, and I started that song in California, but I finished it, this doesn't happen for me often, on a delay in that airport. I walked right by the escalator where I had, tried to crouch down out of sight, and just, I had the song in my head, and I didn't want to get it down, felt very urgent, and that, anyway, it was kind of cool to walk by the scene of the crime.
One of the things that I imagine that you get to do by living in Nashville, even if you are on the road mm-hmm. so often, is you get to be part of that network that exists. And, I mean, you've obviously been doing this for a while now, but I'm curious how you know when to lean on people like the people that produce your albums. We were talking before you started, the first song you play, the last album was produced by Jeffrey Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're
Wisconsin's
like,
own.
Exactly. And so, like, all these people that you rub elbows with, how do you know when to lean on them and when to kind of blaze your own trail and say, I'm going to do this like the way I envision it?
Well, so album production is it's an important cornerstone, I guess, of your music making. It's the only time you get to glue things down to the page in a way. But it honestly, for me, only happens every 2 or 3 years. So most of my time is spent writing songs and touring them around. So recording is a really intense time. This record I just made with Noam Pekelny producing came out of me trying to find my band in a new town. I was playing, I did a couple different sessions. I did some trial runs. I was trying to find the right chemistry of players. And Noam and I had played a couple shows in town. He had joined me on a show when we were both out in Boise together. And he's just an insanely good musician. And I had been playing songs, you know, a couple of my old standbys, and what he would bring to that old standby. And I'd played that with so many wonderful musicians and had heard their ideas contributed to that song. But when I heard his ideas, I mean, he's just really a spark, you know. And so I had been recording. I had not been entirely happy with what I had ready to go. And Noam had played on that recording. And he said, well, I wanted to do one song. It's called Scattershot. It's actually what I'm going to play you. So good question. And so we went into the studio for one day to get one song. I had written a few more, and let's put a band together for one day. And it will be for an album, but, you know, might be a piece of an album rather than the full concept. Turns out that band, Noam played electric guitar. Paul Coer, also in Punch Brothers, played bass. Russ Paul, amazing pedal steel player. We had Jerry Rowe on drums, and it was in Josh Grange's studio. Stuart Duncan stopped by to play some fiddle. This one day, we got four songs. They just felt so right. The band was all Nashville neighbors, but just these folks who have their own, their icons. They have their own personality with their instruments. They're really, they have a strong voice, but they're also such supportive players. So anyway, this was like so much fun. So we booked two more days, and that's my record.
Well, I think before we hear this newer guitar, I should say, Caitlin Canty, it's been a delight. So glad to have met you, and I hope you will grace our studios again sometime down the road.
Anytime. I come here at least twice a year.
Well, it's a date.
All right.
Caitlin Canty's latest album is called Motel Bouquet. She was in town for a couple of concerts at Three Brothers Farm in Oconomowoc in May, and our interview first aired then. Our in-studio concert was recorded by Jason Reavy. And that's all for Monday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.
Yellow edges of light, dust curls, wind sighs like the moan of a faraway train. The rain came scattershot.